Hey, it's April Wolf, host of Switchblade Sisters. Popping in before the episode starts, just to talk about the Max Fun Drive for a second. You know, we're in week four of our Fun Drive, and we know that it's been a tough time for a lot of people, a lot of people that we know, ourselves included. And we just want to say that that is why we are extremely, extremely grateful for anyone who's been able to give and become a member this year, because we know that how hard it is. And we appreciate that you appreciate community. And again, joining Max Fun is quick and easy. You can visit MaximumFun.org/join, and you'll see all the different levels there, all the thank you gifts that you can get with each of them. $5 a month, you can get the huge library of bonus content, including our episode on one of my favorite Murder, She Wrote episodes. $10 a month, you get to choose a cool enamel pin from your favorite show. The Switchblade one is the best. And then you'll have the option to purchase others with proceeds from additional pins going to charity. And then $20 a month, you get the Max Fun custom game pack with Max Fun dice in a velvet bag and the Rocket logo and a deck of custom Max Fun playing cards with podcast-inspired designs. So you can check out all of that and more at MaximumFun.org/join. And again, this is the final week of the Max Fun Drive, so this is your time to give. And if you can't, again, tell a friend. Let someone else know about our show. Maybe they'll like it. Spread the good word. And now for our show. Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. And as you might already know, a reminder, we are remote recording, so, you know, Chicken may come in. Right now she's outside, but, you know, a leaf blower may make an appearance. I'm just warning you right now. The audio is likely going to sound a little different from our studios. Everything else is the same except for our guest is different. Today, I'm very excited to have calling in from Greece, actor, writer, director Romola Garai. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on, April.
Oh, thank you for joining us. You guys can't see, but she's like in a hotel room and looks very ghostly right now. And
it's yeah,
very
sorry. Hot. The sun has just gone down. I've only had one beer, which took an unbelievable level of self-restraint to hang on to this.
I cannot thank you enough, but I also invite you to have another beer if you want. It's totally fine.
Oh, no, don't encourage me. I will. I'll have had four by the end of this.
For those of you who need a little refresher on Romola's career, please let me give you an introduction. She's a writer, director, multi-award nominated actor. She has extensive film, TV, and stage credits, including work with some of the world's finest writers and directors, including Sarah Gavron's Suffragette, Joe Wright's Atonement, Francois Ozon's Angel, Lone Scherfe's One Day, and Stephen Poliakoff. I can never pronounce his name.
Poliakoff.
Poliakoff? Oh, I'm the worst. So Stephen Poliakoff's Glorious 39.
Imagine his name and my name. Why wasn't that film a bigger success? Because we can't say anybody's names who's in it or directed it.
You know, like, yeah, just change it to like Emma...
Yeah, White.
Emma White. There we go. And then everyone knows. Yeah. So also, Romola has extensive lists of TV credits, including playing the lead in Mark Mundan's TV miniseries, The Crimson Petal, ABC The White. On stage, she has played major roles in the plays for The Village Bike for the Royal Court, Measure for Measure at the Young Vic, the writer for Almeida in Queen Anne and Lear the Seagull for RSC. That's a lot.
It's some stuff.
It's a lot. Okay. And then extensive performing credits. She's also known for her writing and directing work, including Sundance Best Short Film.
This
nominated.
Bit won't take so long because it's just two
this
things.
This is the yeah. Phase two of your career.
Phase two of my career is much, much more in its infancy.
It's okay. All right. So phase two, entering now, her Sundance Best Short Film nominated Scrubber. And then we've got the feature film in development with UK top production company, The Bureau, and a number of TV projects that you're working on right now. But the thing that we're really going to be talking about today is her feature film debut, Amulet, which premieres everywhere, I think, on VOD at least, and then in theaters in select places, depending on, you know, how lucky you are with your government. But Amulet is a slow burn horror film that it follows a young drifter with a mysterious past who moves into an old home to help a young woman who is tending to her dying mother. But all is not as it seems. So, Romola, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Border from 2018. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
I love this film more than words can possibly say. And disappointingly for me, I happened to see it halfway through editing Amulet. So you can imagine what it was like when you're trying to make your own film, to see a film that you think is a total masterpiece, sort of in the world of you that you've made your film, your sort of, you know, debut feature in. And I love this film for so many reasons, but I think one of the main reasons is that it feels like it is a film completely about your body and the way that your body dictates the course of your life, and how the way that you look and your relationship with your body and smell and your sexuality and your kind of like the organs of your body and how they kind of dictate the kind of processes of your existence. And it's it's a beautiful film. It's, I think, described on Wikipedia as a fantasy romance. And I don't imagine that that terminology is used that frequently. And I love it for its completely unusual, heartbreaking, beautiful, profound poetry about the human condition. And it's a film full of love, about forgiveness, and it's also about good and evil. And it is more brilliant and more profound and more wonderful than I have words for.
I mean, and we'll definitely get into getting some of those words together. But it's also, I mean, we'll talk about this too. It does go quite dark. And so it encompasses a lot of things, as you're saying. But for those of you who haven't seen Border, today's episode will give you some spoilers that obviously should not stop you from listening before you watch, because my motto, as always, is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Border first, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Border with a quick synopsis. Written by Ali Abbasi, Isabel Eklof, who, love her, directed Holiday.
I mean, where do you even start with the brilliant people involved in this film? Incredible.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. And it's also based on the John Lindquist short story. I think it was about 30 to 40 pages, so novella, I would say. It's also directed by Abbasi for release in 2018. Border stars Eva Melander as Tina, a strange-looking Swedish customs officer who has the unique ability to smell guilt. One day, she discovers a memory card with a bunch of child pornography, and the police recruit her to help in their investigation to find who is making it. Then, another day, this guy, Vore, who looks a lot like Tina, comes through customs. Tina can smell something on him, maybe guilt, maybe something else. They inspect him, and he just has maggots in his bag. Weird. He comes through again, and he's inspected more thoroughly. It turns out he has female genitalia and a scar on his tailbone, which piques Tina's curiosity even more. Tina visits her ailing father, who looks nothing like her, and asks him one more time why she has a scar on her tailbone. And he lies. She visits Four and his at his hostel, where the two eat maggots together.
And then she brings him. No one's gonna want to watch this once you finish.
I know, right? Like, I promise you, it's a beautiful scene, but they are eating maggots. she brings him back to her secluded woodsy house. He moves into the back house, and Tina's quote-unquote boyfriend, Roland, gets very suspicious. Tina then successfully helps the police sniff out the source of the child pornography, but can't figure out who's trafficking the babies who get abused. Back at home, Tina and Vor hide from a thunderstorm, then frolic naked through the forest and have sex, where Tina realizes she actually has male genitalia that suddenly grows from her body. Vore tells Tina that she is a troll, and most trolls live in a hidden existence in Finland. Tina then goes to Vore's cabin when he's away and finds a troll embryo that looks like a human fetus in his refrigerator. Tina is very suspicious, even though Vore says the embryo will die soon if unfertilized. Then, Tina's suspicions are confirmed when Vore kills one of the pedophile suspects to protect his identity. It is Vore who has been stealing human babies and replacing them with troll babies for the operation as revenge for all the experiments humans did on trolls like Tina. Back at home, Tina's friend's baby is dying, but Tina realizes it is actually a troll embryo replacement. Oh, the baby's gone. Vore is gone, presumably having taken the baby with him. She tracks him down to a ferry and she confronts him. To be compassionate is also to be a troll, not just to be human. Vore, however, escapes. Tina quits her job and lives out her life in the woods in seclusion until one day she receives a package. It is a troll baby with a postcard from Finland. Okay, that is the end.
No one is going to go and watch this film now.
Like,
can you imagine pitching that film in like a Hollywood meeting room?
No.
Saying the word troll embryo?
No, that's not something that would be in my my lexicon for a pitch. One of the things I think, you know, that you're maybe hitting on or dancing around is the fact that this film, even though it is weird, Abbasi was very interested in making sure that it was actually just a very simple love story in the central part of it. He said, quote, "I've watched this movie many times now, and still every time I watch it, what sticks with me is the love story. And this is what I was thinking about when I thought about how to treat its characters. So I thought there's got to be some sort of strange romance. And I don't mind it being part of the mix, but I needed it to be something that keeps all the other elements together. If you have a strong love story, you can build other things around it," end quote. And I do believe, you know, that's one of the last pieces of research that I did when I was writing the script for today's show. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. Of course, everything is a love story. I wish that would have been the first thing that I came across when I was formulating my thoughts about it.
Yeah, and that was absolutely the film is great on many levels, but the crime element involving the kind of discovery of the child pornography is, you know, my least favorite part of the film. Mm-hmm. The part of the film that just set me alight was the meeting of these two people, the sense that you've been seen for the first time in your life, and the sense that you've been held for the first time in your life, and the release that comes from that, and the kind of joy that comes from that, and then the sacrifice of having to give it up at the end, mm-hmm. Which it just, I mean, I cried and cried in the cinema. My husband was like, what is happening next to me? I don't understand. But I found it so powerful about love and so kind of revealing about the deep human need to be recognized, you know, and to mm-hmm. be kind of, and the validation that comes from that.
I feel like we should probably get the dark stuff out of the way, because I am curious about this in terms of, you know, how you're approaching this as a filmmaker or even as an actor in your own movie. But Abbasi, when he was, you know, looking at how dark he could go, he didn't want it to be dark for the sake of being dark. You know, he did actual research on, you know, what was happening in the EU and you know, child pornography and what that all meant. And you know, kind of tried to meld it with troll folklore of, you know, like stealing human babies. But it was still a thing where he just wasn't sure how far he could go. He said, quote, "There is always this question when you do a movie about this kind of heavy, serious subject, which you only touch upon. You ask yourself, is it right to do so? Do I have to take it very seriously and dedicate the movie to it, to go in depth and so on? I think our answer was yes, it is a very serious subject and so forth, but this is not what the movie is about. I think we handled it respectfully, not in a too deep, domesticated way, though," end quote.
I think that feels... That attempt that he made to show due diligence and respect to the very serious subject matter, which is always a challenge in a genre film. It is a challenge I also faced with my film because it is about war and rape. But I think that, you know, that you can do service to the deep, important subjects that you want to talk about in a genre film by ensuring that the film is never never uses its kind of voyeurism around that topic. So you kind of fence off part of the film to talk about, you know, in his case, you know, child trafficking for, you know, the making of child pornography, or in my case, you know, the horrors of war and rape as weapon of war, and use that and essentially make sort of a different kind of film around that topic and separate it from what could be, you know, 50% of the rest of the film. And the mixing of folklore with modern day concerns, I never felt uncomfortable watching that film in the way that they were combined.
I want to talk about the idea, you know, I brought up earlier that Abbasi didn't want to work in Hollywood, but in this film in particular, I want to get further into the performances for a lot of this discussion, because the performances here are amazing. Ava Melander is perfect in this role.
I mean, the acting is just stupendous acting.
And it's also extremely difficult acting, and we'll get into that when we talk a little bit about prosthetics. But something that, you know, Abbasi really stood by was the fact that his intimate set allowed for more experimentation from the actors. He said, quote, "Part of what makes it easier for us to have these great performances with Eva and Iro was also the fact that it was a small set. It was an intimate production compared to how productions can be. Still, we're talking about 20 or 30 people there, right? But that is something else in comparison to a couple of hundred people that work on a Hollywood production. I still think that there is this element of intimacy where everybody comes to work, but everybody knows everybody. And after a while, I think that really helps in terms of being comfortable and so forth," end quote.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an actor, and you know, there's the sort of love scene in this film where they finally have sex, and her genitals that had up until this point in her life been a source of profound shame to her and confusion, you know, become engorged, and she's able to make love for the first time in her life. I mean, she's crying, he's crying. You know, the courage and intimacy that it must have taken for those actors to work together in that way, the trust in the director, the trust they must have had in each other, you know, it really is a testament to what he's talking about, is that, you know, you can't make films that carry a kind of vessel of real emotion like that, you know, if you're dealing with 150 people who are stood around in the background all eating cheese and crackers, you know, like you can't do it like that, you know? So
I'm just imagining like, oh, wow, that looks really cool. Yeah. Just like snacking on a snack bar.
You just know that nobody was like eating a protein bar in the background, you know, like that. It just must have felt like a very supportive environment for those actors to be able to give themselves wholeheartedly to that scene. And you can really feel it when you watch the film.
Well, I think also, I mean, if I'm thinking about your film as well, the genre allows for over-the-top performances, I think, in many ways. And when I say over-the-top, I just mean like very kind of theatrical, like they show
Absolutely.
Up on the screen.
Absolutely, melodrama,
and
they're
terrifying and, you know, like the very, you know, fantastical and wonderful. And I do see that in your film. And, you know, how big was your crew?
Oh, yeah, really small. I mean, yeah, 20 people, 20, I mean, I would say even less than that, mainly on a sort of day-to-day level. You know, and also we were filming a lot in a very small house. So, you know, we didn't physically have the capacity to have a lot of people on set. I mean, mainly people were having to like stand in the street outside, you know, and that did, you know, allow the actors to have a sense that they really, you know, along with myself and the cinematographer, Laura Bellingham, you know, we really did control the space around the set, which, you know, hopefully did feel like that they were, you know, their working environment was protected. You know, people talk a lot about that these days in relation to kind of filming sex scenes and stuff, but even just doing emotional things, you know, you don't want to feel ashamed when you're doing that, you know, you want to feel free and you want to feel supported. And, you know, it's not kind of, you know, wishy-washy or like artsy to kind of ensure that people feel that when they're at work doing their job. And a small crew absolutely allows for that.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more border, and also we'll talk some of Romola's film Amulet. We'll be right back. Hey, Hey, it's April Wolf, host of Switchblade Sisters, the show that you are listening to right now. And I'm here to talk again about the Max Fun Drive. I wanted to bring in, again, our really fabulous producer, Casey, who's just had a hell of a time the past few weeks of the Max Fun Drive. Casey, I'm checking in with you. What's going on?
Hi, April. As you know, I've been stabbed, bludgeoned, strangled by someone, and every time it happens, I lose my memory of who it was. And it's been difficult. Yeah, somebody stole my Fabergé egg. That's the big thing. But I don't quite understand why they keep coming back to hurt me. So it's been tough. So I'm up at the lake house. I'm up at the lake house, just trying to be safe and away from other...
Oh, the lake house. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just wanted to... Wait a second. Someone's... Did they follow me here?
Oh, no, not again.
I hear footsteps.
Are you kidding me?
It's... Oh, my God. It's...
Who is it?
Drea Clark.
What?
Hello, Casey.
Drea, I don't understand. So you stole my Fabergé egg?
Yes, definitely. I love an egg.
But then why did you then come back and bludgeon me and strangle me?
Well, Casey, I think it's important that you know a few things. One, this year I made a real commitment to myself that I would get involved in playing the most dangerous game with a coworker. I decided you would be that coworker and that I would hunt you unknowingly. And then two, I really wanted your Fabergé egg. And three, it's very insulting to me that you kept forgetting it was me harming you. So I kept coming back. I will not be forgotten, Mr. O'Brien.
That does check out. That does check out. Yeah. You know, I think, Casey, honestly, I think you owe her an apology. Let's bury the hatchet so we can get into some Max Fun Drive. Not a literal hatchet. You don't have a hatchet with you, right?
I have a hatchet! Yes!
I mean, Drea's an important part of one of my podcasts, and she's frequently on this one, so I guess I'm sorry.
Thank you. That is what I was waiting for. I'll put this hatchet down. Feel free to continue.
Okay. All right, because we've got some Max Fun Drive stuff to get to. First off, I just want to, you know, to segue, I want to say that we're so lucky to have this podcast right now as our outlet, a way to connect with each other in hopefully not harmful ways, Drea, and to feel, you know, like that maybe we're helping our community and providing companionship and some diversion in a very difficult time. Still, it does take technology, time, funding to keep everything going, all the wheels oiled and moving on this fast-moving train. But if you are joining or upgrading your membership, that enables us to keep doing this instead of maybe other things.
Yeah, Drea, you're on Who Shot Ya. You've done this before. Since you're here and frightening me, would you mind telling people how they can give?
I won't mind. I'm glad you remember that we work together, since you didn't remember when I tried to kill you. I can tell you if they want to join, and they should, and I hope they do, because I love April and Switchblade Sisters, and it's worthy of all kinds of support. And you can provide that support even starting at baseline levels like $5 a month, which will get you access to bonus content that I'm also on. If you want to hear my creepy, most dangerous game voice, you can in numerous ways. $10 will get you the bonus content and a pin, and Switchblade Sisters has probably my favorite pin. Sorry, I love my pin too, but also yours is my number one.
Who Shot Ya pin is pretty good.
It's pretty good. Yours is, it's so good. It's just tasty. And you can do all of this very easily on a computer or telephone with computer access at maximumfun.org/join. It's super easy. It's as easy as following someone to the woods, breaking into their panic room, and harming them physically for third or fourth time.
Yeah, some may even say it's easier than that.
I mean, like, it's easy for me to do both, but you're right. It might be easier for some to just join Maximum Fun. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, also this week, we should mention the fact that you can get a subscription for a friend for a year, too. So, you know, you can enjoy all the swag, give a gift subscription. Maybe someone who is had to cancel theirs because of COVID, maybe you can kind of fill in for them. You know, you get the anonymous Max Funster check on the box, and you can fill out the online form again at MaximumFun.org/join.
I just want to pop in here and, you know, say thank you to all of our listeners and people that tweeted us and listened to our show and passed their show on to friends. Switchblade Sisters community is a unique and wonderful community, and it's awesome seeing people get inspired to become filmmakers. And I'm also thankful for working with April Wolf, who is such a great podcast host and such a great collaborator on this podcast, and is doing such good work on this show. I mean, every guest comes on and says her research is so incredible, and she just makes this show super fun to work on and super fulfilling. So I just want to say I'm thankful for her as well. And I said something, I said I was thankful for Drea on Who Shot Ya, and I might have to take that back.
Oh, because come on. She has the hatchet's buried. It's you know, in the ground. I
see the hatchet. It's not buried.
I'm thankful for Drea. I'm thankful for her being our biggest, brightest star so many times on the show. You're up there with Chicken, who is a lot of our listeners is favorites, and that's a high compliment. And again, I want to thank Casey because he is so patient when I'm very frustrated with technology and heat. and you would be surprised at how impatient I can get with technology and heat. But we thank all of you guys for listening. Everything that you do for the show is amazing. And all you do also is elevating women creators. And I think that that's always so important. The marginalized creators of our time are finally getting a voice. And it's just so cool to see everyone coming together to give them their due. So again, if you want to support what we do, if you want to support what Drea does at Who Shot Ya, which has some amazing film criticism and film discussion, you can just go to MaximumFun.org/join.
Drea, since you admitted your crime to me, could you give me back my Fabergé egg?
Yeah, no way, man. I'm going to cash that in because I'm running off with Nana's caretaker.
Totally hot.
Oh, very shit. Hot.
Well, that was a lot of drama. Now back to our show. Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today from Greece by Romola Garai, and we're talking about Border. So I wanted to bring it back to something that we had talked about before, which is these performances and how we can kind of see them through these very heavy prosthetics, how that makes things quite difficult. Let's talk about the creation of those prosthetics, because it's a thing where, I mean, you know, when Abbasi did like Shelley and his other, he wasn't like doing a ton of prosthetics before. He wasn't like, this was kind of new to him. And he was very honest about that when he was talking to Goran Lundstrom, who was the designer, the makeup designer for Eva and Eero. And he really didn't know exactly what he wanted. He was kind of trusting Lundstrom to help him and guide him. So Lundstrom said, quote, "We did the test makeup for this and it gave Ali something for him to work with. I based the design on what I could get out of him. Even though he didn't have a good idea, they were talking about makeup that would take less than an hour. And then when I started investigating what he wanted, I started to get an idea that he wanted more and more and more. We ended up having 9 prosthetic pieces covering the face. Once we got to that point in the design, they asked, could we make the makeup time shorter? When it came to actually designing it, I think I got a sketch that looked Neanderthal. My job became how to make her look something close to that, but not Neanderthal and not too fantastical," end quote. So it was a really collaborative effort, but, you know, even though Abbasi didn't know exactly what he wanted, you know, he had so much great trust in Lundstrom to make this work and to find it there. And I think that that's like a huge leap of faith.
Yeah. And I think that the makeup feels like it's done with real humanity, you know, like exactly mm-hmm. as you kind of described in the quote, you know, it was important that she, you know, had the appearance of something definitely other, but there's a beauty in it as well. And, you know, there's a complete sort of, also, I love what the work that they did with her body. You know, her body has hair on it, but it's very delicately kind of drawn, the hair on her body. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like the whole thing was done with a lot of respect. You know, there was never any othering being done with her as the kind of central character. And I'm sure the actress fed into that as well. And there is a real sense that these departments were working respectfully and closely together and showing sympathy for the central character.
I, you know, the prosthetics that you have in your film, was that kind of a trip to figure out? Was that like a learning process for you?
Well, so the prosthetics that we had on the mother in my film, I mean, that, you know, to a certain extent, that was a very, very old woman who is revealed at the end, mm-hmm. you know, to be something other than that. And in that sense, that part of it wasn't too difficult. You know, I've seen that kind of aging being done. I knew what was required. I knew what would work and what wouldn't work so well. The big challenge for us was the deity figure at the end. That is a full prosthetic suit. I didn't want the entire image of the deity at the end to be visual effects. There are mm-hmm. visual effects in the film. We've kept them to a minimum. Mainly it's practical effects. I wanted it to be Carla in a physical suit that we could, you know, physically see moving. I mean, the eye, for all visual effects brilliance, you know, we can still detect that difference. And I wanted people to know that it was her there. And also it meant that Alec could actually respond to her and, you know, in the scene. And mm-hmm. also I thought it was, you know, it was important in a way, although it's a kind of some of the background around her as a visual effects, but you know, he's inside a physical object. The shell was a physical object. Her suit is a physical object. You know, I am a great believer that we're still, you know, predominantly as human beings, you know, we have a different relationship with physical objects. We can detect mm-hmm. them, you know, and it changes performance and it changes the audience's relationship to things. And that felt very important to me.
And this actually, I mean, like if you listen to any of the commentary too, like it's a full collaboration. And one of the things, you know, like it became a collaboration like the second that Eva Melinder had auditioned for this. First off, they were having a really hard time finding anyone for this role. And
yeah, 18
we
months
can get
I had.
It was like really tough because a lot of people didn't want to get ugly. And you know, we can talk a little bit about what Eva Melinder had thought about that. But in the audition process, you know, Eero had already been cast as Vor, and so Abbasi just had, you know, women come in and play against him. And so he said, quote, this is after he said, like, I want you to come in and say, and then just like, you've met this love of your life and you didn't know. Like you, all of a sudden, everything is awakened to you. And he said, quote, she just blushed. It was this little thing that almost made me cry. She had an inner life that the other characters didn't have and the other actors didn't have, end quote. And I thought that was really lovely that she's just, like he gives her this direction and she blushes. And it was not something that he had really thought about before, because he said, quote, Eero, who plays Vor, was already cast, so I used him to choose the girl. So I told Eva to concentrate on that part. You see him and you've never seen him like this before. You fall in love, but you don't know what love is because you haven't realized it. So you're more shocked than romantically attached. And she did this take, and he came and he looked at her and she blushed. She was red all over the face and I started blushing too. Suddenly it became so awkward, that situation. I hadn't thought about it being awkward. I thought it was funny and a little bit weird, but I hadn't thought about that scene being awkward and serious, end quote. And so all of a sudden, she has this reaction that changes the whole trajectory of this romance and these two characters together in the audition process.
And it's such a testament to him as a filmmaker as well, that he's able to see that as well. You know, like he's not looking for someone to walk into a room and do grand gestures. He saw somebody who came into the room who instinctively was able to meld his note, which was, mm-hmm. you know, show somebody falling in love, with an essential truth about the character, which is, you know, somebody who feels that level of shame about themselves and their body, you know, it's not going to be a grand gesture, you know, and the subtlety, the simplicity, the kind of purity, for want of a better word, of her as a character, you know, it was perfectly described by this actress. And it was testament to him that he was able to kind of recognize that and then go forward with, you know, a true collaboration with her, because it really is the most heartbreakingly beautiful piece of acting.
Have you had that happen to you before at all, where you like, you come in and you like make some choices and the director responds and they're like, yes, you understand, like make the character your own?
Yeah, I have. And actually, like, it's one of the best things that any actor that can happen to an actor, you know, because I think, you know, there's a real like, I think, longing in a lot of actors to be kind of recognized and seen by directors and to feel like they're being, you know, that you're representing a kind of elemental human truth, you know, and that you're getting close to something that does that, you know, to contribute, for want of a better word. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's an amazing thing if a director says, you know, you've brought me something that I didn't see, or you've introduced something to the performance that I hadn't known was there.
Well, let me say a quote from Eva Melander that I, you know, maybe you'd have some thoughts on. She said, quote, "When I started acting in Sweden, I always felt as if I had to create my own character because I didn't feel as if they were there. They were just written from a familiar point of view, girlfriend, wife, friend. The story was always about somebody else. I think I'm quite trained in creating characters who have souls and lives, even if they're roughly written into the story," end quote. And, you know, overall, I think what she's trying to say is just that the, you know, marginalized actors might be better able to create characters from nothing because they've had to do that for themselves with poorly drawn people their entire careers.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And also just the incredibly demoralizing experience of being an actor who has profound talent and isn't being given the opportunity to kind of utilize it in favor of people who you probably know for a fact are not that good, you know, mm-hmm. the way the industry works, you know, it's not fair and just in that way. But the fact, if you stay with it and you make it your life, you know, you're going to have a kind of level of respect for and dedication to it as a job, and a sense that it's worthwhile, that, you know, is going to make you very detailed and hardworking and, and contributory in a way that I think there are plenty. Also, the thing is, you know, if you haven't had as many opportunities, you really work your nuts off when you're given one, you know, mm-hmm. which is, of course, very useful.
And I think, you know, when it comes to Border, you see a lot of Abbasi kind of letting his actors kind of go wild. You know, for instance, that scene in the forest when she's kind of like communing and she's just like touching everything and like, you know, seeing everything in like a new light.
And they jump in the lake and they're like in the rain.
Yes. Obviously said, quote, "When she did her first take in that forest, we talked about it, that sensuality and connection that her character has and human beings don't have. And actually what you see in that sequence, it's her interpretation of that. It wasn't necessarily in the script, but it was just as another layer on top, her contributions, also how she walks, how she talks," end quote. And you know, he's also using the same word, the contributions, you know, like, how do you contribute to this character, to this production, to the story? And I love the idea that that wasn't in the script, that she like communes in the forest. It was just like, all right, send her out naked, running wild, and see what happens.
Yeah. And the, you know, I keep coming back to this moment only because it's so beautifully acted, and you know, that this moment where they make love, and mm-hmm. she, you know, I think it's something that I really found very moving, because when you're a woman, your genitals are like mainly on the inside, you know, and so your sexual kind of journey is very confusing and, you know, can last a lifetime for some woman. But mm-hmm. to see that moment where she understands what her genitals do and what they're for, and like mm-hmm. has an orgasm, like it's sort of like she discovers she has a clitoris, you know,
yeah.
and it's so beautiful. And, you know, the actress Eva Mendler is crying, and they feel it's very, profoundly moving, and it's not something that an actor can do unless they felt totally comfortable. It's one of the most kind of intense and revealing things I've ever seen on screen, and like that, yeah. she's weeping in the scene, and I it just it profoundly affected me because of the truth of it.
Yeah, Abbasi actually fought to have that in there. Like his you know, production was just like, this is going to be absurdly comic. Everyone was laughing when he was like, I want to see them have sex and I want to see him give birth. Like, these are the two things that I want. And they were like, this could go horribly awry. But he had enough trust in his actors to actually pull it off and to make it feel real and emotional. So something that has always struck me about this film is the cinematography, because it is a great deal of naturalism. It is, you know, not exactly what you would expect from, you know, like we said, a prosthetics heavy movie, an effects heavy movie, a fantasy. And Abbasi had a very, very kind of strict idea of how he was working with cinematography. And he said, quote, I've been working with my cinematographer, Nadim Carlson, since way back. We were in the same year at film school together, and we did my first little sketches at the film school together. We did Shelley together as well. Nadim, aesthetically, comes from still photography. He has a very specific taste. He knows what he likes and what he wants. He has a very experienced hand, even if he's not very old, and at the same time, he's not tricky to work with. This is my principle, though. I'm not interested in making beautiful pictures. If you sit there and think the music is great from the beginning to end, then something is wrong. If you sit there and think, oh, such a great actress, look at that silicone mask. Of course, at times you can think about that. But if you think about it all the time, and especially with the cinematography, I have this thing where if a frame or a reel looks too good, then I cut it out. Because I don't want to get from the cinematographic experience to a photographic one. That was our main ideology, so to speak, end quote. Do you feel like you discovered a lot about your kind of cinematographic preferences when you were working on Amulet?
I did want something that felt quite sort of artificial and constructed for one part of the film. One part of the film takes place inside an old, creaky house. And the film is very consciously an effort to utilize certain tropes of the genre in an effort to then explode them. But then we also have a section of the film that takes place in flashbacks, which is shot in a completely different way. And actually our original intention was to shoot, we did use different lenses and we did different things in the gray, but our original intention was to shoot part of the film on digital and part on film, 60 millimeter, so that we could kind of explore those distinctions even further. You know, that what everything that takes place inside the house is very constructed. There's a lot of paranoid angles. It's a lot of, you know, sort of slow slides and all of the things that we understand from kind of classic horror. And then there's this other part of the film, which is, you know, largely handheld and feels much more naturalistic in its styling. And so I suppose that's, you know, that's in a sense, that's developed my understanding of the different ways that you can use film to tell story. But also, you know, I think with Amulet, I was very committed to the idea of the film having different aesthetics and not attempting to make them cohesive necessarily, mm-hmm. because I wanted the flashbacks to feel part of a very different time. And that sense, in that sense, when you watch it, it can feel aesthetically jarring sometimes because you're going between two different things. But then I quite enjoyed that as well. You know, I think, you know, there's always a sense whenever you make a film that you go into it with questions thinking, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if this is going to be right. And when you know, through the process of making it, you know, you discover that it's working, maybe not in the ways that you'd expected it to.
I think, you know, it's an interesting thing. Because Amasi has some quotes from about flashbacks when it comes to how he was adapting this. And he was really refusing flashbacks because he didn't think, like, his flashbacks would have required a different actor. And I think that was the breaking point for him. He said, quote, generally speaking, flashbacks are a great literary device. They work well in literature, but not always in film. There are a few people that can do it very well. Mostly it doesn't sit well. It feels like a foreign element to me. Even when I see a film and I go, oh, this is a flashback. In literature, it works to have, let's say, a line like, when he was 5 years old, this happened or that happened. Because you don't see the main character. You imagine him as a child. And in that way, you keep the continuity. Whereas in film, there's another actor playing that 5-year-old kid. So it's actually not the character in your perception. At least my brain works like that, end quote. And I think, you know, it's a different thing. You know, if he had flashbacks in Border, it would have required like a 5-year-old troll
and
actor.
They wouldn't have been able to do the prosthetics on the child. Exactly. So they exactly. wouldn't, I mean, there's no way that a child would sit there for 4 hours while you did it. I don't think it would have been, I mean, yes, I think, you know, he makes a very good point just technically about how flashbacks are less successful in film as a medium as opposed to literature. But also just technically, it wouldn't have been possible with this film. You know, you would have had to have been flashing back to her life as a teenager, mm-hmm. which wouldn't have been enough of a distinction in time to make it, you know, to make it useful.
Yeah, there's, you know, and then if I think of, I would say your film is almost less of flashbacks and more of parallel storylines of two kind of like running parallel lines that intersect.
I mean, thank you, but also they're flashbacks and it is really hard. Like the man speaks the truth, you know, it's really challenging and it did make a lot more sense on the page because mm-hmm. exactly as he says, you know, what you say in a line of prose, you know, we cut to 5 years earlier, you mm-hmm. know, you have to establish that in the visuals. You immediately have to kind of employ a whole set of devices to kind of reframe your film. It is very challenging, you know, and the edit.
Yeah, you just
was
made
not,
your job harder.
Yeah, I made my job a lot harder and the edit was not easy. It was very difficult. And, you know, finding the places to put those flashbacks because the flashbacks reveal so much about, you know, who he is in reality, you know, it mm-hmm. wasn't easy, but you know, it's a great thing to set yourself a significant challenge early on in your career, because, yeah. you know, I wouldn't change the experience of having to sit in that room with Al, my editor, going, oh God, what am I going to do about the flashbacks? The running time is 3 hours. You know, it wasn't easy, but you know, it was, it was a very instructive period of my life.
Yeah, you should have had, you know, a few kids and dogs in there next time.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of back up to something also that we were talking about in terms of choosing locations, because there was a very kind of specific guiding principle that Abbasi had in choosing his locations, because you were talking about the house and, you know, like finding like a very specific place. But he was always over choosing the mundane over the extraordinary. He said, quote, "We were talking about how to bring life into the story, how to keep the realism so that the magical becomes more believable and plausible. We decided to approach this with a kind of naturalism, a little bit of a social realist approach. We were careful. We were still just following the actors around the room, but we wanted a little bit of reality present. Part of it has to do with cinematography, but part of it has to do with production design. The way we chose the police station, for example, we had a lot of choices for that location, and I had a lot of discussions with my production designer because I wanted to go with the boring one. She said, it looks like every other police station we've seen. There's nothing special, but there isn't anything special about a police station. That's what I wanted," end quote. And I think that's it's a risk, because if you are doing any kind of production design or location scouting, like, yeah, you kind of want like the unique thing. And he was just like, give me the most boring shit you can find and let's book
yeah.
it.
And you see it all the time in film. You see people turning up to, you know, what should be, you know, a police station in a small town in England, and they've shot it outside the Commonwealth office in London. And you're like, you know, it's like a massive building, you know, or you know, as he said so sort of astutely before, you know, it's the attempt to aestheticize everything, which mm-hmm. makes seeing anything impossible, because, you know, if you put everything at the same level, you know, you're never going to see anything. So it was brilliant that he chose a really boring police station, because he then has a very beautiful house. Yes, it's mundane. Yes, it's shot in a social realistic style, but it is a sort of little sort of pinpoint of life in this sort of extraordinarily dense and magnificent forest, you know? Mm-hmm. So there are sort of, yes, naturalistic kind of choices, but there is a great deal of beauty to her sort of bungalow in the woods, which, yeah. you know, and it's completely right that that is separated so distinctly from the boring police station, the nursing home, you know, the border office where she does her work, because that does feel very grounded in reality. And then they move into something that feels, you know, more sort of magical realist when you enter the forest.
And, you know, I'm curious in terms of like finding your special house, you know, finding... Like,
oh,
how...
God, that was a nightmare. Oh, it was awful. I mean, we got to like 2 weeks before we were supposed to start shooting. I mean, maybe 3 weeks. And it looked like we were just going to have to push the film. And then it might not happen, you know, in the way that these things will just sort of fall apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd done all the stuff you're supposed to do. We'd found, you know, locations through a locations company. I just couldn't find anything right. You know, sometimes you say old spooky house and someone takes you to like a mansion in the middle of a field. And I'm like, no, it's in London. You know, it has to be a row house, you know, like a terraced. It has to be a terraced house. But, you know, London is every single terraced house in London is now like in New York or whatever is now, you know, a £3 million house with a gym in the basement. So mm-hmm. It wasn't easy to find that. And eventually we just did this kind of weird thing where I think the day before it looked like we were going to have to push. I went on a property search engine and just put in some keywords, you know, and was like derelict. Recently exchanged, you know, and we found this house which had been lived in for 50 years. It had all the period detailing. It was completely empty. We could do anything we wanted to it. The very nice couple who owned it just said, you can have it for a month and, you know, and then we'll bring the builders in. And it was extraordinary to have that kind of freedom because our amazing production designer, Francesca, just went in and she changed all the walls. She ripped up the carpet. She changed the glass and the windows. She just absolutely kind of was able to create what she needed inside the space. It also meant that because we weren't having to shift locations, although we shot in, you know, 4.5 weeks, mm-hmm. we were able to do everything very intensely inside that house. The attic was a set build because the house did have an attic, but you couldn't stand up in it. Wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
You can't
ask for everything. Beggars can't.
No,
be
you can't. But we were able to just shoot in that place, not move around. We weren't having to pack up the kit and go elsewhere. And thank God, because otherwise, I don't think we would have got filming again.
Well, I mean, from my own experience too, I realized that like shooting in cities is. Been getting maybe a little bit more and more difficult in terms of finding locations that don't feel polished, that don't feel gentrified in a way. And I think that that's getting harder in major cities. Sometimes you can find them in smaller cities, but it's, you know, a trade-off where you can get the great crew and the great cast if you stay in a central place like London or Los Angeles or New York, but then it's really hard to afford all of the other things that go into it. So there's like a constant trade-off unless you have, you know, some special place like your house.
I would say that like my number one takeaway from making my film was that, you know, the minute I started writing the words, it is a rundown, large terraced house in London. I should have been trying to find that property. I should have been mm-hmm. trying to nail it down years beforehand, you know, because then I could have written to the space as well. I think that there's a lot to be said if you know that. If you know that a location is going to be like significant in your story, mm-hmm. like write for it, like it was a character, you know, find that place, work out where it is, speak to the people who own it, you know, just like make it commit, you know, that because they are so incredibly important in filmmaking.
So Romulus, it's about our time to wrap up, but I just want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your film, your career and Border and sharing your love for that movie with us.
No, thanks so much for having me. It was amazing to get to watch it again. And, you know, I hope that this means that some more people watch it because it is just such an amazing and beautiful film.
Awesome. And again, Amulet is going to be available VOD and in select theaters, some drive-ins too. What's the date that the
It was actually the 24th. It's been out for a couple of days now.
Okay. So it's the release the 24th. So it's available everywhere. So go and take a look. Amulet. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Did I say thank you? I can't remember if I said thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being a part of the show's community. And you've taken that extra step to join as a Max Fund member. Remember, extra thank yous for that. You are making the show possible. And, you know, please know that we are grateful for your support. We're grateful for your tweets. We're grateful for you listening, for telling a friend, all of it. It just makes our day brighter, and we hope that we can make your day brighter too. Again, if you haven't had a chance to become a member yet, this is the final week of the Max Fund Drive so that you can do that. So you can do it at maximumfund.org/join. And if you would like to tell us what you think of the show, You can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.